The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, by Robert A. Caro. Part 2, continued on cassette number 9, side 1. This handful of men included William O. Douglas, 38, a sandy-haired former Yale Law School professor, who, as an SEC commissioner, was a key figure in the administration of the Holding Company Act. The holding company in the utilities field had become a monster, he was to write. And it included the first man Douglas had brought to Washington to assist him, a short, slight, silent young Jew from Memphis with olive skin, large, liquid eyes, and, another Yale professor says, the most brilliant legal mind ever to come out of the Yale Law School, 26-year-old Abe Fortas. It included Janeway, a 24, a Washington-based business writer for Time, Life, and Fortune magazines, and 27-year-old Arthur E. Goldschmidt, known as Tex, because he came from San Antonio, who had been brought to Washington after graduating from Columbia University, and who worked under Harry Hopkins. With the exception of Janeway, these men, Corcoran, Cohen, Douglas, Rowe, Fortas, Goldschmidt, often saw each other at work. For a time, in fact, three of them, Cohen, Fortas, and Goldschmidt, occupied adjoining offices in the suite used by the Division of Public Power on the sixth floor of the Department of the Interior. And they saw each other after work. Corcoran and Cohen shared an apartment, and the younger men, Rowe, Fortas, and Goldschmidt, all lived within a block or two of each other in small rented houses in the Georgetown section of Washington that had until recently been a Negro slum but was rapidly being taken over and refurbished by young white New Dealers. We were a kind of a group, Goldschmidt says. We were not organized, but we knew each other, and we saw a lot of each other. And they began to see a lot of Lyndon Johnson. He met them in the course of his work for the Marshall Ford Dam. He would telephone and ask them to lunch. He would invite them for Sunday afternoon cocktails at the small one-bedroom apartment he and Lady Bird had rented in the Kennedy Warren apartment house on Connecticut Avenue. And soon they were inviting him back. The little group would often get together for informal dinner parties or for backyard cookouts, and Lyndon and Lady Bird became regulars at them. He cultivated them. He was, in the beginning at least, deferential, attentive to their opinions. He listened with what seemed like awe as Tommy Corcoran talked about how the lights had burned all night in the Treasury Department when, back in 1933, they had been trying to work out a plan to save the banks. He gave them small presents, a locket for a baby daughter, for example, small but appreciated. At that time, we were not so used to getting presents, Jim Rowe says. Though you've warned me about pestering you with mash notes, Elizabeth Rowe wrote him, I can't allow anything as lovely as your little locket to go unnoticed. Really, you do spoil our daughter. I can't think of anything nicer to wish for my daughter than that you would be an honorary uncle. So from now, you shall be Uncle Lyndon. Small and large, the largest being Texas turkeys that, beginning in 1937, were hand-delivered by Johnson's secretaries every Christmas to all the members of this group. When she received her first turkey, Mrs. Rowe was astonished by its size. I had never seen such a big turkey, she recalls. I didn't have anything big enough to cook it in. Telephoning Johnson to thank him, she said, You must have had a turkey crossed with a beef. When they were promoted, they received his enthusiastic congratulations. Johnson wrote Rowe when he was made one of President Roosevelt's 6 administrative assistants. My dear Jimmy, if I owned a big truck such as the movers use and get in front of me with when I'm in a hurry to go places, I couldn't send you more congratulations on your elevation today than you will find borne by this note. I rejoice with you, and I rejoice with our president, that he has such an able pair of shoulders as yours, and such a fine mind as you to relieve him of some of the crushing load. He helped them. On the day, May 13th, on which he had arrived in Washington as a newly elected congressman, the first office he had visited had been that of the newly elected majority leader, and in that office he stooped down and kissed a bald head, and the grim face beneath it had broken into a smile. Sam Rayburn was very glad to see Lyndon Johnson back in Washington. When Johnson asked him to stand beside him at his swearing-in in the well of the house as his sponsor, he was very touched. The furniture in the Johnsons' apartment was a little worn from use by previous occupants. But starting on the very next Sunday, their apartment was frequently adorned with the short, broad figure that was, in the catalog of Washington Power, a more prized ornament than ever. And Rayburn returned the hospitality in a very significant manner. One of his first acts after his election as leader had been to reinstitute Jack Garner's Board of Education. And each day after the House had adjourned, a handful of congressmen met in a room on the ground floor of the Capitol to strike a blow for liberty with a late afternoon drink. The men invited to this hideaway, which was furnished only with dark leather easy chairs, a long dark leather sofa, a fireplace, a desk at which Rayburn presided, and a picture of Robert E. Lee, were almost all leaders of the House. The single exception was Wright Patman, who possessed a qualification that was, in Rayburn's eyes, more important than seniority. He had been one of the little band of populists in the Texas legislature who never sold out. One day, Rayburn invited Johnson down for a drink after the session. Thereafter, leaving the floor at the end of the day, the leader would frequently growl to Johnson, "Come on down." Behind the hideaway's tall, narrow door, the 28-year-old freshman was drinking with Speaker Bankhead and Minority Whip McCormick and Rules Committee Chairman Sabath, and as a result, he knew quite a bit about the inner workings of the House. The young New Dealers from the White House end of Pennsylvania Avenue were in constant need of information about the Capitol Hill end, about the chances of passage of some bill vital to their agency, about the status of the bill, where precisely it was stalled, in committee or subcommittee or the bill drafters' offices, and why and who could get it unstalled. Their bosses were constantly asking them to find out some piece of information about Congress. Obtaining such information was no trouble for Corcoran, who could get it through the White House liaison men. In some matters, he was the liaison man. Or for SEC Commissioner Douglas. But the more junior Rowe and Fortas and Goldschmidt had to get the information themselves. And hard information, not rumor but fact, was difficult to obtain from the closed, confused world of Capitol Hill. But Johnson, thanks to his attendance in Rayburn's hideaway, often had the information. Moreover, they had seen with their own eyes that he knew Rayburn well. The leader, with his immense power and fearsome mien, was an unapproachable figure to them. Loving the company of men young enough to be his sons, Rayburn had begun, after he had spent enough time with Corcoran and Cohen so that he could relax a little with them, to invite them occasionally, perhaps once every 6 weeks or 2 months, to his little apartment for a Sunday stag breakfast, which he would cook with a big apron tied around his chest. Even on such social occasions, however, the leader's reserve never melted more than slightly. None of the young men ever felt close enough to ask him the questions they needed to ask. But these young men saw, with the same amazement with which Lyndon Johnson's San Marcos classmates had watched him pat the feared Prexy Evans on the back, Lyndon Johnson lean over and kiss the leader's bald pate. They knew that if Johnson didn't himself have the information they needed, he could get it from Rayburn. On minor matters, he might even on their behalf ask the leader not just for information but for assistance. Furthermore, he was learning his way very quickly through the maze that most congressmen never master. He learned the levers in Congress very fast, Rose says, and he was willing to place his knowledge at the service of this small group of men. "I would call and say, 'How do I handle this?' Rose says. He would say, 'I'll call you right back.' And he would call back and say, 'This is the fellow you ought to talk to.'" Says Fortas, "He was close to Rayburn and an ever-widening coterie of friends on the Hill, and he helped us. He ran errands for us on the Hill. He was very useful to us. And he made them like him." "At parties he was fun," Elizabeth Rowe says. "That's what no one understands about Lyndon Johnson, that he was fun." He was, in fact, the life of these parties. Quick wits flashed at them, and none flashed quicker than his. "When I think of the old Lyndon, I think of old-fashioned joshing, kidding around," Goldschmidt's wife, Elizabeth Wickenden, says. "The small talk was great," Jim Rowe says. "He always had a good Texas story that was in point." He knew three worlds, the world of Congress, about which they knew little, and two worlds about which they knew nothing, the world of Texas politics, and the world of the Texas Hill Country, the world from which he had come. He spoke to them about those worlds with an eloquence they never forgot, his voice now soft and confiding, now booming, the voice of a natural storyteller. He was always ready with the latest inside stories about Congress, stories on which they hung because such information was important to them, but also because in the telling he mimicked accurately and hilariously the characters he was talking about. Pacing back and forth, a tall gangling figure in those small living rooms, he filled those rooms with drama. His greatest stories, Mrs. Rowe says, and the rest of the group agrees, would be about Texas. He told them about political figures of whom they had hardly heard. Ma and Pa Ferguson, Big Jim Hogg, Jimmy Allred, but whom he painted in colors so vivid that they wanted to hear more. And when he talked about the Hill Country, then, Mrs. Rowe says, he could be very eloquent indeed. He talked about the days of the cattle drives, and about the poverty of the people. Bill Douglas, a great talker himself, frequently talked about soil conservation. Even Douglas's stories paled before tales of the rampages of the Pedernales or the lower Colorado. And when Johnson was talking of the poverty of the Hill Country and about what New Deal programs meant there, then even Tommy Corcoran, customarily the life of every party himself, with his Irish chatter and his accordion, might stop talking for a while. And it wasn't just his stories that made them like him. He was a great player of practical jokes. On the morning after a cookout at the Fortises, at which the Johnsons and George R. Brown of Brown and Root had been guests, and at which Brown had had a bit to drink, a bouquet of flowers from Brown arrived for Carol Fortis with the note, "Sorry if I misbehaved." Since he hadn't, the Fortises were puzzled. When Fortis asked Johnson what Brown meant, Johnson said that the next morning he had told Brown, whose memory of the evening was hazy, that he had dropped a steak, liberally covered with Worcestershire sauce, on the Fortis' living room rug. He entertained. At a Spanish restaurant one evening, flamenco music was playing. Johnson, so tall, grabbed little Welly Hopkins, and the two of them jumped up on a table and began dancing together. "There was never a dull moment around him," Fortis says. "If Lyndon Johnson was there, a party would be livelier. The moment he walked in the door, it would take fire." Maybe in a different way than the party had been going when he came in, but it would take fire. He was great fun, a great companion. Says Elizabeth Rowe, "He enjoyed living so much that he made everyone around him enjoy it more. He could take a group of people and just lift it up." As they got to know him better, their fondness was, more and more, tinged with admiration. Politics was their profession, and they were, most of them, very good at it. This little group included men who were already, or would be, among the master politicians of the age. A master of a profession knows another when he sees him, and they knew they were seeing one now. Rowe, asking Johnson more and more frequently for information on Congress, came to realize that the information was invariably correct. Following this freshman congressman through the maze of Capitol Hill, one would make very few wrong turns. They all came to realize this. He knew how things happened, and what made things happen, Fortis says. He knew the nuts and bolts of politics. We were all more or less technicians, and he was the best technician, the very best. Counting Congress, estimating the votes on bills important to them, was a frequent pastime at the parties. He was a great counter, Rowe says. Someone would say, "We've got so many votes," and Johnson would say, "Hell, you're three off. You're counting these three guys, and they're going to vote against you." He was the very best at counting, Fortis says. He would figure it out, how so-and-so would vote, who were the swing votes, what in each case, what exactly would swing them. Fortis pauses for a moment, then he says, "I may not have adequately explained to you how good a politician he was. He was the very best." They admired his thoroughness, his tirelessness, the way he threw himself into every aspect of politics, into everything he did, with an enthusiasm and effort that seemed limitless. He already possessed an amazing store of knowledge about individual congressmen and their districts, through his capacity for absorbing and retaining information. He was a pack rat for information, Fortas says, and he was very, very intelligent. He never forgot anything. He would work harder than anyone else. I've never known a man who had such a capacity for detail. Recommendations were the order of the day for these canniest of the young new dealers. All of them were working to insert friends and allies into key positions in government agencies. Lyndon Johnson was doing this, too. He was always pushing someone for some appointment or other, Rowe recalls. And a Johnson recommendation had special quality to it. Rowe recalls one of the first vacancies he was put in charge of filling after he became a White House administrative assistant, an assistant attorney generalship. One of the names on the list was Welly Hopkins. Rowe thought he might casually ask Johnson for information about him, just because he was from Texas, too. He had certainly no intention of giving Johnson, a freshman congressman, any input into the appointment. But, Rowe recalls, I called Lyndon up and he said, "I'll be up." Startled, Rowe asked, "What do you mean?" "I'll be up in 10 minutes, replied Johnson. And 10 minutes later, Johnson, having run out of his office in the Cannon Building, jumped into his car and roared up Pennsylvania Avenue, was in Rowe's office in the old State Navy and War Department building next to the White House, pounding on my desk in a nice way and saying, "The best man!" "Lyndon," Rowe pointed out, "you don't know who the other men are." But Hopkins got the job. Rowe and Corcoran, disciples of Justice Holmes, called the tirelessness and enthusiasm that they admired energy. Holmes used to say that in the last analysis the only thing that mattered was energy, Corcoran says, and Lyndon just bristled with it. Fortas, more precise, says, "It was a matter of intensity more than anything, an intense concentration on whatever was being talked about, or on whatever was the problem in hand." But however they defined it, they admired it. Admired it to such an extent that while they might feel that they themselves were, in Fortas's word, technicians, some of them were beginning to feel that Johnson might be something more. Fortas customarily cloaked himself in reserve and an air of gravity that he may have considered necessary for a man who was very young indeed for the posts he held, and who looked even older. Or his reserve may have been natural. "I was born old," he once told Goldschmidt, almost ruefully. Sometimes he seemed to be measuring every word he spoke. He had already adopted the mannerism of stroking his chin slowly before answering a question, and he seemed determined never to let himself reveal enthusiasm. Elliot Janeway was astonished, therefore, when Fortas expressed his feeling about Johnson to him, and added, "The guy's just got extra glands." Listening to Jim Rowe speak about Johnson, one can hear beneath the words the struggle of a strong personality to avoid becoming submerged in a personality still stronger. "Listen, I mean, I worked for Roosevelt and Holmes. They were the two perfect people. Johnson was never going to become one of my idols. He and I were of an age. But he didn't bore me for 1 minute. He never bored anyone. He was a magnetic man, physically, and you never knew what was going to happen next. He was a remarkable man." In this little group of remarkable young men, he was becoming not merely one of the group, but its center. Soon the small Johnson apartment was the scene of more and more parties. In honor of Maury Maverick, Harold Ickes, who had decided to attend Johnson's party instead of a big garden party at the British Embassy, was glad he did. Practically everyone was in his shirt sleeves. "I'm sure that I enjoyed it more than I would have the formal doings." For Ickes himself, on his birthday, Johnson asked Fortas, then PWA General Counsel, to make a little speech in Ickes' honor. "That shows how smart he was," Welly Hopkins says. "By giving the party but allowing Abe to make a birthday speech for his boss, he kept his foot in the door with both of them." The parties didn't have to be formal occasions. "He was a great one for spur-of-the-moment parties," Elizabeth Rowe recalls. "He'd call up and say, 'I'm about to leave the office. Get old Jim and come on out.' When the Rose arrived at the Johnson apartment, they might find two or three other couples also invited by a last-minute telephone call. More and more, wherever the parties were held, he dominated them. His size was one factor in this dominance. He was, of course, over 6 feet 3 inches tall, and his arms were very long, and his hands very big, and the sweeping, vigorous gestures he made with those long arms seemed to fill those little rooms. His awkwardness was a factor, the clumsy, lunging strides as he paced back and forth, telling his Texas stories, the ungainly flailing of his arms to make a point, as was his restlessness, which kept him always in motion, sitting down, jumping up, walking, talking, never still. The drama of his appearance, which went beyond size and awkwardness, was a factor, too. The vivid contrast of the coal-black hair and heavy black eyebrows against that milky white skin, the outsized nose and huge ears, the flashing smile, the flashing eyes. But the dominance went beyond the physical. Although he was only 28, he had been giving orders for a long time now to L.E. Jones and Gene Latimer and the rest of the staff in Clayburgh's office, to scores of NYA officials. He was accustomed to being listened to, and the air with which he carried himself was, in part, the air of command. And it was also the air of belief. He was more than a natural storyteller. The subjects on which he dwelt, the subjects his anecdotes all illustrated, were the poverty of his constituents and the need to do something about that poverty. And in describing Lyndon Johnson, the words the members of this little group use are vibrancy, vitality, urgency, intensity, energy, and passion. His belief in what he was fighting for just poured out of him, says Elizabeth Rowe, and it was very impressive. As he strode back and forth in those little living rooms, he was, in their words, eloquent, spellbinding. And often they were spellbound. Not always, of course, and when they weren't, his behavior was also striking. Even as a boy, of course, he could not endure being only one of a group, in a companion's phrase, could not stand not being the leader, not only of boys his own age, but of older boys. If he couldn't lead, he didn't care much about playing. The need to dominate was as evident in Georgetown living rooms as in the vacant lots of Johnson City, as evident with Abe Fortas and Jim Rowe and even Tommy the Cork, as it had been with Bob Edwards and the Kreider brothers. Most of the group, Fortas and Rowe and Goldschmidt and their wives, gave him their full attention during his monologues, but sometimes they wouldn't. And sometimes there were other guests, guests not under his spell. In Washington, the amount of attention a man could command was often in proportion to the amount of power he commanded, and a junior congressman commanded none at all. As Rowe puts it, he was somewhat of a young congressman, and he was interesting, but eventually people would drift off and start having their own conversation, or would interrupt him and hold the floor themselves. And if he was not the center of the stage, Lyndon Johnson refused to be part of the cast at all. He would quite literally go to sleep. In a group of people in a living room, he would be talking. Someone else would begin talking, and Johnson would put his chin down on his chest, his eyes would close, and he would be asleep. He might stay that way for quite some time, 20 minutes or half an hour, say. He probably wouldn't wake up until Lady Bird nudged him. And when he woke up, as Rowe puts it, he woke up talking. And if he was not then afforded the attention of the group around him, he would go back to sleep again. Elizabeth Rowe describes the sequence this way. He'd put on a performance and then pull the curtain down and then pull it up again. The members of the little group forgave him this behavior. Fortas excuses it as a result of what he feels was understandable fatigue. A man who lives at this intensity. Elizabeth Rowe doesn't attempt to explain it, she just forgives it. Asked whether she as a hostess didn't resent one of her guests going to sleep in her living room, she replies, "Anything he did was all right with me, because he was such a good friend." And because, she adds, when he was awake, he was such a marvelous, scintillating guest. Says Welly Hopkins's wife, Alice. He demanded attention. He demanded it, and he got it. He was demanding it now, and getting it from men who gave it to few men, generally only to their superiors and to other older men with power, not to men their own age without power. And Lyndon Johnson, their own age, had no power at all. Summing up Lyndon Johnson's relationship with Fortas, Rowe, Douglas, Goldschmidt, Corcoran, and Cohen, Rowe says, in words echoed by most of the group, "Roosevelt and Rayburn liking him, that gave him the in, and the personal force did the rest. That had to be it, because there was nothing else. He didn't have power or money or anything. He just had this personal force. a huge, unique, personal force. And he used these men. Hawthorne said of Andrew Jackson that his native strength compelled every man to be his tool that came within his reach. And the more cunning the individual might be, it served only to make him the sharper tool. These were very cunning men, and Lyndon Johnson made very sharp tools of them. They didn't realize this, of course. In fact, they vehemently deny it. They felt that they were using Lyndon Johnson at least as much as he was using them, and this feeling was important to them. They were clever men and proud of their cleverness, practical men and proud of their pragmatism. It was important to them that the upper hand in any relationship be theirs. The thought that someone might be taking advantage of them, getting more from them than they from him, would have been difficult for them to swallow. The thought was, in fact, difficult for them to swallow 40 years later. The author learned quickly that one way to bring a frown to their faces was to so much as hint that Lyndon Johnson might have been using them more than they were using him. But he was using them. An element of mutuality did exist, of course. Johnson was, in Fortas's words, running errands for them on the Hill, giving them information on what Congress was doing, and tips on how to get something done by Congress. But the mutuality was very heavily weighted in Johnson's favor. He was performing essentially minor chores for them. But what he got from them in exchange was not minor. It was, in fact, the largest thing in his political life during his first years in Congress. What he got from them was the Marshall Ford Dam. To get the dam completed, he not only used every one of these razor-sharp weapons, he used them with consummate judgment, putting each to the specific use for which it was best suited. He didn't need their help on Capitol Hill, not with Rayburn, the grim power of his personality reinforced now with the power of the majority leadership on his side, and with Roy Miller still wheeling Joseph Jefferson Mansfield through the Capitol corridors. Time to obtain congressional authorization for the dam was very short. Mansfield's Rivers and Harbors Committee was scheduled to issue its report on the project on May 24th, just 11 days after Johnson's arrival in Washington. But in those 11 days, Johnson obtained what was needed. Not merely authorization, but the type of authorization Alvin Wirtz had devised. Noting that the Marshall Ford Dam has never been specifically authorized by Congress and its legality has been brought into question, the report said that, therefore, Section 3 of the House Rivers and Harbors Bill would read, "The project known as Marshall Ford Dam, Colorado River Project in Texas, is hereby authorized, and all contracts and agreements which have been executed in connection therewith are hereby validated and ratified." Validated and ratified. The contracts under which Brown and Root had been working may have been unauthorized. With passage of the bill, they would be authorized. But Johnson needed the help of the young New Dealers at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, and he needed it badly. While the first step toward congressional authorization had been taken, many other steps, approval of the committee report by the full House, approval of a Rivers and Harbors bill by the Senate, reconciliation of the two bills by a conference committee, remained before authorization was a fact. And Herman Brown, $500,000 in debt and with his cash running out, couldn't wait for them. He needed fresh infusions of cash. Such cash was available under the original appropriation made the previous year. But the Comptroller General's office and the Bureau of the Budget were delaying approval of new allocations under that appropriation until these steps had been taken. Even more important, while the ex post facto validation and ratification contained in the House bill made Brown and Root's contracts legal as far as congressional authorization was concerned, it did not solve, but only blurred, the question of the possible deeper illegality posed by the fact that the dam was being built on land not owned by the federal government. Puzzling rumors about the dam were beginning to circulate among bureaucrats, and had reached the ears of one or two Republican congressmen. An investigation would focus attention on the land ownership question, and would make it difficult for the Comptroller General's office and the Budget Bureau to justify new allocations. The delays had to be ended, and the growing bureaucratic curiosity about the dam dampened, and this could only be done by help from the top. In obtaining this help, Johnson employed his bluntest weapon. This was Corcoran, the broad-shouldered, bouncy, brash Irishman who in 1937 stood, Joseph Alsop and Turner Caplidge wrote, closer to the throne than any of the young New Dealers, and who was already a Washington legend for his enthusiasm in using that closeness to bludgeon officials into compliance with his wishes. If a fond president had nicknamed him Tommy the Cork, the rest of the Capitol called him White House Tommy because of his predilection for beginning his telephone conversations. "This is Tommy Corcoran calling from the White House." And when he called, Alva Johnson wrote, "Cabinet officers, senators, commissioners, stand at attention. Smart people who want to get action at headquarters ignore the regular secretariat, overlook the cabinet, and cultivate the acquaintance of White House Tommy. He can get things done." Despite the favorable impression he had made on Roosevelt, Johnson found that it would not secure a freshman congressman entree to the White House. So, Johnson used Corcoran's entree, asking him to raise the subject of the Marshall Ford Dam with the president. Corcoran found the right moment to do so, and Roosevelt's response was all Johnson could have wished. Corcoran recalls that Roosevelt said, "Give the kid the dam." With Johnson urging him on, Corcoran made the most out of the president's words, and out of the president's name. Roosevelt probably was never made aware of the legal problems involved. Corcoran himself may not have been aware of all of them. But whatever the problems, the president's order, as implemented by Corcoran, was enough to settle them. The precise nature of Corcoran's dealings with the previously recalcitrant Comptroller General's office and the Bureau of the Budget are not known. Corcoran will not discuss them except to say, "I made a hell of a lot of calls on that dam." But the refusals by these two offices to authorize additional allocations out of the first appropriation abruptly ended, and the previously growing curiosity about the dam abruptly vanished. The president's casual word, hammered home by Corcoran, painted approval on the Marshall Ford Dam with a brush so broad that minor points were buried forever beneath the paint. Even with the authorization finally in hand, the second appropriation, the second $5 million, of which Herman Brown would get to keep $2 million, proved difficult to obtain. The money was supposed to come out of work relief funds. The $1,500,000,000 emergency work relief bill that even then was wending its way through Congress. But Work Relief Administrator Harry Hopkins pointed out that since the Marshall Ford Dam was being built not by a government agency, but by a private contractor, since the cost of materials far exceeded that allowed for non-labor items, and since the labor involved was highly paid skilled labor, the appropriation would violate at least three fundamental work relief provisions. These objections were registered in July, less than 2 months before the initial appropriation would be used up, with Herman Brown still $500,000 in debt. A letter from Brown's banker, Thomas H. Davis of the Austin National Bank, told Johnson that Brown was already beginning to close down. "Activity on the Marshall Ford Dam is practically at a standstill." On July 20th, Brown and Wirtz, accompanied for window dressing by the rest of the LCRA board, flew to Washington. Tom Connolly was attempting to circumvent Hopkins's objections by placing an amendment in the Senate version of the work relief bill, but objections arose in the conference committee over a provision so obviously contradictory to the bill's intent. Connolly, despite the power he was beginning to accumulate in the Senate, could find no way around the problem. But White House Tommy could, with an assist from Bill Douglas. Johnson asked Corcoran and Douglas to intercede. The precise nature of their maneuvers are not known, but Jimmy Roosevelt, James H. Rowe, Jr. secretary, began making telephone calls, and Connolly was asked to withdraw his amendment because it was no longer needed. Hopkins quietly withdrew his objections, and on July 22nd, Johnson, Wirtz, and the LCRA directors were invited to the White House. There the president's son handed them the papers approving the additional $5 million appropriation, making a point of telling them that the president was happy to do this for your congressman. In case they didn't grasp the point, it was reiterated by Hopkins when the group was ushered over to his office. "We are doing this," he said, "for Congressman Johnson." The dam, The dam that represented so much to Alvin Wirtz and Herman Brown was secured. Alvin Wirtz's investment in Lyndon Johnson had paid off. Tommy Corcoran was Johnson's bluntest weapon. Abe Fortas, too young to have entree but gifted with that lawyer's mind at which other lawyers marveled, was the sharpest. This weapon, too, was to be called into use. Herman Brown had his dam now, so he wanted the dam to be bigger. On November 30th, 1937, just 4 months after Johnson had rescued him from financial disaster by obtaining the vital congressional authorization for a $10 million Marshall Ford Dam, Brown's construction superintendent, Ross White, speaking at an Austin Rotary Club luncheon in the Driscoll Hotel, urged that the dam be made higher at the cost of an additional $17 million. The next speaker, Howard B. Bunger, who was supervising construction for the Bureau of Reclamation, said that the dam must be made higher, for its present height would be inadequate to control large floods, and he urged all interested persons to contact the congressman representing this district and urge construction of the high dam. When the next speaker moved that the club's board of directors prepare a resolution endorsing the dam, it was obvious that Brown, who was sitting quietly in the audience, had orchestrated the meeting. Ray Lee wrote Johnson that evening, "It seems definitely that a carefully staged coup was pulled to get the thing into the public demand stage." Johnson's first reaction, and Wirtz's, was fury, both political. The statement that the dam was inadequate to provide flood control was embarrassingly accurate. Wirtz, of course, had never intended it to provide flood control. Despite his statement to the contrary, he had always intended its primary purpose to be the production of hydroelectric power, which could be translated into political power. And personal, the two men felt that Brown had taken advantage of them to obtain a bigger profit. Wirtz's anger was also fueled by fear. The first interest payments on the LCRA's outstanding bonds were due on January 1, 1939, and the only way to meet the payments was by the sale of power from the LCRA dams. Power could not be sold until the dams were completed, and Brown's proposal would mean that the Marshall Ford Dam, at least, would not be finished in time. Under the terms of the bond indentures, the bondholders would foreclose and take over the project if an interest payment was not met, and the holder of the bonds was the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, whose director, Jesse Jones of Houston, was a longtime enemy of Wirtz, who would only be too pleased to snatch his project away from him. Wirtz urged Johnson to see federal officials immediately to make sure that the dam would not be enlarged. Even before the Rotary meeting, the alliance between the Browns and the two politicians had grown shaky. Wirtz's plan to use the 2,000 construction jobs at Marshall Ford as the payroll of a Wirtz-Johnson political organization had been defeated by Brown's refusal to cooperate. Bunger had received quiet instructions from his superiors at the Bureau of Reclamation not to hire anyone unless they bore a paper from Wirtz and Johnson saying they were approved. But Brown refused to accept this. "He moved him off," Bunger would recall. "Herman could be rough. On a Herman Brown job, you earned your money." But a dispute with Herman Brown would not be in Johnson's interest. His ambition dictated the avoidance of a dispute, and as always, his passions were at ambition's command. By the time, a week after the Rotary luncheon, that he wrote his first letter on the subject of the High Dam, a reply to T.H. Davis of the Austin National Bank, who had written him to wonder why the present dam, now well underway, if it be so inadequate, was ever contracted for, his anger was banked, the letter diplomatic. Had he already realized that the support of Herman Brown was necessary for the attainment of his great goal? Seemingly insurmountable problems stood in the way of a high dam, however. The additional $17 million could not come from the LCRA, for not only had the authority used up all its authorized borrowing power, even if it was authorized to borrow more, it would not be able to pay the interest on new bonds. Every cent of possible revenue that could be generated from the sale of power was already pledged to pay the interest on the existing bonds. And how could the money come from the Bureau of Reclamation? The Bureau could build, out of its own funds, only the flood control part of the dam. Any money spent on a dam or that part of a dam designed to provide power had to be reimbursable. And how could the Bureau maintain that the high dam was not for the purpose of providing power? It had said the low dam was for flood control, and the low dam was funded. Any additional funds would have to be for power, would have to be reimbursed, and there was no possible source of reimbursement. The Wiley Wirtz was working on a solution. Under it, the existing 190-foot-high dam would no longer be a flood control dam. It would, with the stroke of a pen, be designated a power dam. The flood control portion of the dam would be the part not yet built, the additional 78 feet, and therefore the Bureau of Reclamation could legally pay for it. But Wirtz's solution, while ingenious, did not provide a rationale for changing the nature of the 190 feet already built, and it left unsolved another major problem, the result of the fact that the dam was in reality meant primarily for power production. This reality could not be blinked because there was a recognized, accepted, standard formula for determining what portion of a dam was to be allocated to flood control and what portion to power production. By the most generous estimate possible under this formula, no more than $14,850,000 of the cost of the Marshall Ford Dam could be allocated to flood control. The rest had to be chargeable to power production. But it could not be charged to power production because the power production portion was reimbursable, and the LCRA had no further capacity for reimbursement beyond the $9,515,000 it had already agreed to pay. And the two figures, $14,850,000 plus $9,515,000, totaled $24,365,000. The dam would cost at least $27 million, so there was at least a $2,635,000 gap that could not be filled by either of the two agencies connected with its construction. Standing in the path of Herman Brown's ambition was an intricate legal tangle. Brown could see no way to cut through that knot, nor could Wirtz or Corcoran. So, Corcoran says, it, the problem, was turned over to Abe Fortas. Johnson telephoned the Browns to report on the situation, as George Brown recalls it. On his, Fortas's, desk was where the reclamation thing had landed. He was the key to the whole thing. If he said it, Wirtz's scheme, was illegal, it was dead. Aware of the weaknesses of his case, Brown felt that it would be touch and go, but Johnson told him that if any lawyer in the world could solve the problem, Fortas could. And in fact, Fortas did. He worked out an elaborate rationale for Wirtz's plan, and he bridged the $2,635,000 gap. Since that money could not be provided by either of the two agencies building the dam, Fortas proposed that it be provided by a third agency, the Public Works Administration. At first glance, legal barriers stood in the way of this solution, too. The PWA was not authorized to build flood control structures, and it was not authorized to build dams for the production of power, either. But Fortas reasoned, in an elaborately structured memo to PWA Administrator Ickes, that it could build a portion of the dam whose purpose might be defined as neither flood control nor power, because its purpose would be both flood control and power. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.